Well, let me just say a little bit more about the program. Then we're going to introduce our guest. This is Business Radio, Sirius XM 111, of course. And we'd love to have you join our conversation tonight. Call in 844-942-7866. Join the dialogue. And in the meantime, do send us the mountain that you would love to climb. Email it. I'll give you the address or the place to contact us a little bit later in the program. In the meantime, though, Richard LeBlanc, welcome to our program tonight.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great to have you, Richard. We have a copy of your book in the studio. I'm going to put it right in front of me now. It is.
Please use two hands when carrying Richard's book.
No, come on, and you guys. It's less than 10 pounds. Well, since it's a handbook, everything's got to be in there.
And Richard, two handbook.
It is. So, Richard, let me say a little bit about the handbook and then about you. It's called The Handbook of Board Governance. The Handbook of Board Governance, just published by a major publisher called Wiley & Sons. The subtitle, though, is very helpful. A comprehensive guide, comprehensive, everything, pay, size, committees, who should be on a board, how to deal with underperforming board members and well beyond, and it's for public, private, and nonprofit board members. So if you're thinking about joining a board one day, going on to a community board, say, or even an advisory board, or whatever it may be for public, for the private, or nonprofit sectors, this really is one of the books to acquire, just published, and Richard, congratulations on its publication.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I think it just came out 2 weeks ago, and all indicators are that it's selling pretty well.
And Richard, it's very timely because in the last 10 or 15 years, many academics and many people who cross the line between academe and practice, like you, have given a lot of thought to the topic. There's a lot of research and a lot of great guidance, and it's all put together between these two covers right here. Richard, just to add to your description, if you will, you're on the faculty, as we mentioned a moment ago. You're an associate professor of law, governance, and ethics. You're the director of the Masters in Financial Accountability Program at York University. And I know directly, we've had contact over the years, that you work with many organizations in Canada, in the U.S., and abroad that are looking to strengthen their governance. So let me take that as an introduction, Richard, and turn it into a question. As you've looked at boards, maybe we'll begin by bunching everything together, nonprofit, for-profit, private boards, boards of private, non-publicly traded companies. If there's one thing that board members and maybe a managing director or a chief executive could do, excuse me, to improve their governance, to strengthen what the board does, what would you point to?
What I ask directors is, what's your biggest regret? And the invariably what they tell me is that I didn't speak up when I had the chance. So I find that really interesting because boards, I think, are social beasts, and this concept of groupthink, which is a board is a group, right? It's a group, and it's not like senior management. It comes together, you know, every 2 or 3 months and for a limited period of time. So they don't work together in the sense of continuously. But there's a tendency to prematurely agree for the sake of agreeing. It feels good to agree. So not speaking up is the greatest regret that directors have, and I find that a little interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Richard, let's turn that around. If somebody says, look, I should have spoken up before we made this acquisition that turned out to be a disaster, your response is, next time there's a moment to speak up, why don't you do the following? What would you recommend so people have a more, I don't know, a greater readiness to be active in the conversation before it's too late?
Did you remember that movie Columbo, with the detective, and he wore an overcoat and he was sort of bumbling and humorous at the same time? When you're thinking of something in a board, chances are there's two or three other directors that are thinking the exact same thing. So there's no real stupid questions. You can ask you don't have to ask a question in an aggressive way. You can be humorous about it. You can be soft. You know, you can approach it obliquely, but you know, ask the question. The other piece of advice is that the one thing that directors have said that regulators have actually gotten right over the last 10 years is this concept of executive sessions, which is when management leaves the room. And that gives directors a bit of a safe space to talk amongst themselves and to talk about concerns and to talk about the CEO. So creating a forum, a portion of a meeting, and good boards now, they do it. Some good boards do it every meeting. They do it. They do it at the beginning to set the tone, and they do it at the end when directors are warmed up. So creating, there's a reason that people don't speak up. Management can be intimidating, lack of knowledge, homogeneity of the group. What we find too is that if boards are not diverse, they tend to think alike, and you don't have that, you know, female directors, especially two or three female directors. We have movements now in various countries. I think the last count was 49 countries. There's movements towards diversifying boards to act as a catalyst for asking, you know, for asking the question. I think homogenous groups can tend to, you know, not ask different questions. So those are a couple of suggestions for asking questions.
That's great. I've got one quick final thing, then I'm going to turn it over here to Anne. On a thinking now in a little bit more in the negative, in a boardroom, kicking yourself for not speaking out, have you also encountered directors who have been self-critical because they allowed somebody else in the room to dominate or misdirect the conversation or try to micromanage the chief executive? So my guess is you've seen that, and if you have, what's the solution to that one?
I've seen that a number of times, and it could be the CEO, and particularly when the CEO also occupies the role of chair. That means a number of companies in America have this, where the CEO also chairs the board meeting, and that's a huge concentration of power in one person. In other countries, you know, Europe, the UK, Canada, for example, we generally say, listen, the CEO should not be the leader of the board, and that means that's a different dynamic, Mike, because that means that there's an independent director who's actually running the meeting, and the CEO is almost, you know, less powerful. That model can work, a CEO chair, if it's the right type of person that doesn't dominate. But CEOs are hard chargers; they're Type A personalities. There's a tendency for them to, you know, almost without sort of intention to really have a chilling effect on other directors.
By the way, this is Leadership in Action. Our guest this hour is Richard LeBlanc, Associate Professor of Law, Governance, and Ethics at New York University, and our focus is corporate governance.
Richard, this is Anne, and so nice to have a chance to speak with you.
Hi, Anne.
When you talk about the boards, you remind me of a recent interview we had with a colleague of ours, Mario Musa, who's written a book with colleagues called Committed Teams, and he talks about roles, goals, and norms or expectations. So when you talk about speaking up or making sure that someone doesn't dominate, then you're getting to the culture of the board.
Uh-huh.
So can you talk, you know, either by way of the negative or the positive, what are positive aspects of culture for boards? Boards that work well, what kind of culture do they have?
They're peers. A board is a collection of peers. No one person dominates. They leave their ego at the door. They disagree without being disagreeable. they're very polished when it comes to style, political acumen, humor. They make sure everyone speaks. There's a good tone set by the chair of the board in terms of preparation. Everybody arrives warmed up. They ask good questions. Their tone, their body language. No one has a sort of vested interest in a particular outcome, or is no one's conflicted. If someone is conflicted, they'll stand up. They'll leave the room. That that type of culture, is when you see it live, it's a beautiful thing. it really is. That's the positive aspects of that. That's not that just doesn't happen. That's boards that are very careful about selecting members with the right competencies, and they do due diligence, they do interviews, they look at behaviors, they talk to people who have worked with an incoming director, so they choose directors very wisely, and they tend to moderate dysfunctional behaviors if they occur sooner rather than later.
That's good. I'm going to hand the baton to Jeff in just a moment, but you mentioned members, and I've always wondered about this on boards. Are there distinct roles for each member, or are there sort of group roles, subunits within the board?
Well, that's a good question, and the board is composed of committees. So, there are committee chairs. There's a board chair, then there's committee chairs, and then there's committee members. So people on the board tend to have different expertise. They tend to weigh in. Like you'll have, for example, a cybersecurity expert or an accountant or an activist shareholder, for example. So they will, directors will naturally turn to certain directors, other directors that might be experts in that area for commentary. But as Mike said earlier, that doesn't mean that person has the final word. It's a collection of peers.
Very good. All right, Jeff.
Hey, Richard.
Hi, Jeff.
So I think I want to maybe pull up to 40,000 feet here if we can, and we're getting into some of the characteristics of high-functioning boards and successful boards. But just to ground the conversation a little bit, can you describe what's the role a board plays within an organization, and then maybe we'll differentiate by some of the sectors here?
Well, the board has two roles. One is to oversee management. And one is to compliance role, and the other one is a strategic role, which is to approve the strategic plan, to link achievement of the strategy with pay, to approve financial statements. So it's largely an oversight role.
And is it a legal requirement to have a board?
Yeah, every organization has to have a board. So public, not-for-profit, state-owned enterprises, they all have boards.
And I mean, so if I think about small businesses, for instance, is there if I set up sole proprietorship, those kinds of things, do I or I'm running a limited partnership?
Yep.
Do I need a board there?
Yeah, the board would be Jeff. If you set up Jeff Inc., then
I'm chairman of the board of Jeff Inc.
Uh-oh.
And I'm selling Jeff.
This is the best day I've had.
The owner-operator sets up a board, and he's the sole director.
Got it.
Right? But you know what? Eventually you're going to want money, right? You're going to want money from friends and family and angel investors, and you're going to have a great idea, and it's going to take off, and then you're going to want some institutional investors, some shareholders. And you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, well, you know what, Jeff? If I give you my money, you can't be the sole director. We actually have to have some board meetings. And,
you know, Ann and I have been thinking the same thing.
Exactly.
So eventually when you start taking money to grow and to expand, then someone might say to you, you know what, not only do we need to have board meetings, Jeff, but if I'm going to give you a big pile of money, then I might want a board seat. So that's how boards evolve from an idea, an entrepreneur, to a functioning board.
Got it. And are there, you had said public companies, private companies, all need a board. And so I understand the de facto board is founder or executive until these kind of other considerations come into mind. Are there distinctions at all between for-profit and non-profit boards?
When you look at the surveys, they tend to be, what are the issues for both? They tend to be pretty similar, but the reality is that not-for-profit focuses much more on mission, vision, stakeholders, whereas for-profit, it tends to be shareholder maximization as the driving consideration. So not-for-profits, they include, for example, universities, hospitals, charities. Some of these not-for-profits are huge, and they have multiple moving parts, and they can be pretty large. The boards can be pretty big, and they can be a challenge to operate. But your fiduciary duty, if you sit on a not-for-profit board, is the same as a for-profit board. The law doesn't treat you equally, so you still have a duty to oversee.
Got it. That's really helpful. Do I have time for one more? All right. Well, we may have to pick some of this up after the break, but the other kind of pressing question on my mind is, I hear a lot and I read a lot about activist investors.
Mm-hmm.
Should I be rooting for activist investors?
Well, there's two sides to that. I mean, if you're rooting for activist investors, it's because the thinking is that you wouldn't have activist investors if boards were actually doing their jobs.
Uh-huh.
And what frustrates activists is that the management is underperforming and the board is not stepping in to fire management or to increase performance. And that's why activists now are targeting boards, because if you want to change a company, you get one or two activists on the board. And I've seen this play out where a person who understands the business, has been there, has done that, can actually moving a room. We need someone to move the room. And that means you've got someone who can, we had a famous one in Canada where Bill Ackman came to Canadian Pacific and he fired the CEO, Fred Green, and he replaced him with a terrific CEO. The stock price started to improve. So that's the plus to the activists. The downside is that they have a reputation for being short-term and largely in it for themselves and not all shareholders. So I'll tell you, if I had to pick one driving thing in the last year that has really put pressure on directors, it's the threat of activism, which is, well, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because boards have stepped up and they're talking about strategy much more now.
So, Richard, we're going to come back and talk about this after a little bit of a breather. Just want to say that we've been talking with Richard LeBlanc, a associate professor of law, governance, and ethics at York University. And Richard, we're going to continue our dialogue after a breather. When we come back, I'm going to put a question in front of you, and I'd like our listeners to be thinking about it. How does somebody go about getting on a board? So we know they're out there. There are community foundations, community groups galore, hundreds of thousands of nonprofits, and literally hundreds of thousands of for-profits. They all have to have a board, as you said. So when we come back, do call in on this, Richard. We're going to ask you how the heck you get on a board. In the meantime, I'm Mike Yuseem. I'm here with Jeff Klein and Ann Greenhall. We're speaking with Richard LeBlanc, as I mentioned. Stay with us as we continue our conversation. And you, of course, are listening to Leadership in Action, business radio powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111. Welcome back. Leadership in Action, Sirius XM's business radio powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Mike Yuseem, along with my colleagues and co-hosts, Jeff Klein and Ann Greenhall. And we're speaking this hour with Richard LeBlanc, the editor of a new handbook of corporate governance, subtitled A Comprehensive Guide for Public, Private, and Not-for-Profit Board Members. Richard, without even asking a question we should spend some time on, is it good for somebody to join a board? Let's say yes, that the answer is yes on that. We could come back and reference that. And let's say somebody would like to join a board and they're not on a board and they've never thought about it. They don't have the connections to be a natural candidate to join a board. What's your guidance for our listeners out there who literally have not thought about it, or maybe have thought about it and haven't managed to do it, about joining a community foundation board or the local YW or YMCA board there, or maybe a small company in the community? How should they go about it? What do you think?
Well, that's a good idea, and I think it's a very rewarding thing to do. Directors tell me, the first board is the most important board, and choose wisely, and that's where you can sort of establish your reputation. It's kind of like in university. Your resume gets you your first job. Your first job gets you your second job. So networking is important, and making targeting, being strategic about it. If there's a community board, keep in mind, every organization has to have a board, and a lot of it is just shamelessly, diplomatically reaching out. Directors say we don't know where qualified directors are. So if you're a person that you think you can make a contribution, you know, you have a resume, a short bio, you send it in. Send it in to a lot of the community organizations. They don't use recruiters. They just use word of mouth. So being assertive, you know, there's a school of thought that you wait. Well, you might be waiting until the cows come home. You have to sort of be a little assertive about it and you know, have a profile and network and make your views known that you'd be interested in serving. And that's how plenty of people have done it. And they've, and, you know, going to education sessions where you network with directors. Now there's LinkedIn, you know, online, looking at recruiters, Spencer Stewart, Korn Ferry, those types of things, sending resumes. We also have drivers, just to end on this note, we have diversity now, and we also have term limits and we also have the population growing older. So we have a generational shift now where directors are being asked to serve, and we have in Canada, for example, we have a quota that was announced last week of 40% females. 50% of our boards don't have a single female director on them. So governments are sort of prompting the change as well. Term limits of 9 years and 10 years in many countries. So we're at the beginning of a change in the demand for directors. There's much greater demand and the supply. But I would say if you're a potential director, it's a very rewarding opportunity. Normally, you start on a not-for-profit board, and then a career trajectory for a director takes about 10 or 15 years. You don't start on a Fortune 500; you work up to that. But you start small on a small board. You make a good contribution, and then you're invited onto a larger board, and then a private board, and then a small cap board, and then it goes from there.
Richard, I got a very tangible follow-on that. Are there, call them watering holes in towns, cities, maybe metropolitan areas, where as a prospective board seeker, you could come and hear people like you speak about board service, but also kind of get into the network, become known? And before we get to you on that one, are there similar places on the web where somebody can go to make their interest known and also learn about what they're going to have to do to finally find a board seat?
Yeah, there are internet portals that are available that the shareholders are using, and there's diversity groups as well, and there's recruiters have their own portal. The directors associations also have portals where you can go in and you can submit your resume, submit your qualifications, and they will do they will link you with prospective boards that are searching. So it's like a lottery ticket, right? If you're not sort of in one of these watering holes, then you're not known. So the watering holes can be sort of electronic. About 50% of them are electronic, and the other watering holes are networking at educational events, at conferences, seminars, particularly during the coffee breaks. For example, the NACD in Washington, they've got their annual conference. It's about 1,000 people that go to it, and that's where you search for prospective directors. And a lot of it can be just sitting beside someone at a conference for an hour and exchanging business cards. You hit the nail on the head, Mike. Yep. You need to be at a watering hole.
And NACD is National Association of Corporate Directors, probably?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Just a final question about one word. If you're going to get on the web and search for both types of watering holes, what would you search on?
Directorship, non-executive director, independent director, board of directors. There's several groups on LinkedIn I've got a group. It's got 20,000 members. It's called Boards and Advisors. It's on LinkedIn, but there's no shortage of electronic watering holes.
Richard, I might just follow up and go backwards to one of Mike's earlier questions, and just to detail a bit about why someone would want to serve on a board.
For three or four reasons. At the initial stage, it's not for the money, because many not-for-profits don't pay. It's to learn. Directors tell me, I serve on the board to learn, to feel young, to give back, to have fun, to contribute. to network, for education. You know, there's a whole bunch of non-financial reasons to mm-hmm. serve on a board. It's very rewarding. Mm-hmm. You know, despite everything in the press about all these responsibilities being imposed on directors, it's not insurmountable. It's a great learning experience. The average directorship is about 278 hours a year. So take it seriously. Don't go on if you're not prepared to put the time in. But there's a huge upside in mm-hmm. terms of going on one or two boards and serving and pushing your limits a little bit. So it's I highly recommend it.
I ask you because we have a popular program here one of our colleagues runs in which he matches MBAs to local nonprofits in which they serve and in the process, you know, enhance their own leadership development. And now I can't resist, I have to ask about you and, you know, as an academic and someone interested about boards from an intellectual perspective, are you yourself on a board?
Yeah, I'm on two small boards, but most of my board experience is from assessing boards and working with boards, and it makes me a more effective educator if you work in some capacity, if you mm-hmm. work with a board. Otherwise, it's kind of like a fork trying to hold water. and you can tell when, you know, there are governance academics that don't really have the practical experience. So the more practical you can become, I think the greater the likelihood is that people will listen to your advice. And so I've probably assessed, I would think, over 100 boards, and I've probably interviewed over 1,000 directors, and I've done that over the last 10 years. I've learned more from doing that than from reading articles or sitting in a classroom. So governance is an active sport. You really have to be out there and engaging with directors in order to understand it.
Richard, a quick question as a follow-up on that before we go over to Jeff here. By implication of what you've just said, if you're looking to, say, go on your first board or to begin to get into that world, sitting down with somebody in your family or in your network who does serve on a board is probably an invaluable conversation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I would reach out to family and friends who can kick doors open for you and can tell you what it's like and can tell you the sort of real deal about the dynamics in a particular board, particularly when you're targeting boards and doing your search. They tend to be really good contacts to have.
Along those lines, Richard, are there any objective sources that you can, not that family isn't objective, but that you can go to check that you'd also recommend? I mean, I'm thinking in the nonprofit world of some of the, I can't even think of what it is right now. But so let me ask you the question.
Well, yeah, you can. You'd look at former directors. They tend to be much more honest than current directors. So it's almost like 6 degrees of separation. If you're targeting a board, you should know someone who knows someone on that board.
Got it.
And before you even make the ask or the suggestion that I'm potentially available, you talk to people and say, you know, is there – oftentimes, you know, you're looking for insurance. Are they properly insured? Is there any allegations of fraud? You do Google searches. Is there any, you know, issues with executives or with sexual, you know, you do a thorough reputation check
right.
of the board first before you say, okay, I'm potentially interested. So a lot of this is really doing your homework and getting objective advice at the beginning.
And just to clarify there, though, it sounds like it's a lot of, you know, kind of personal outreach, one-on-one outreach. Is there anything, I mean, it seems like in the world now we rate everything. We rate our Uber drivers, we rate our doctors, we rate our professors. Is there any independent entity that's out there making assessments of boards?
Yeah, the proxy advisory firms do.
Okay.
National Association of Corporate Directors, they will you know, have opinions on certain boards that you can go to the board's website. You can tell quite a bit about a board just by going to the website. And you know, if you don't see the board and if you don't see, you know, what you want to see is the picture of the director. And we just
right.
had this regulated last week in Toronto where the websites now have to have the following. They've got to have who's on the board, who's chairing, who's the executive management, what are their ages, their pictures, their length of tenure on the board. So you can just do your own research as well and get a good idea of whether the board's effective or not.
Richard, I want to break in for a second and remind listeners, this is Leadership in Action, and we're speaking with you, Richard LeBlanc, on the faculty at York University and the editor of the new Handbook of Board Governance. And Richard, we have somebody calling in from Michigan. Ken, I think we've got you on the air.
Hi, Ken.
Ken,
hello.
Ken, and I understand from our producer here that you actually have set up an organization for people who want to join boards. So hope you got a question for Richard on that very topic.
Yes, well, it's a question and perhaps a statement and or an opportunity. We've established in Chicago the Private Directors Association. It's essentially an NACD type organization, specifically devoted or targeted for private companies. And we really say we have four pillars: the private company pillar, which includes family business, ESOP organizations, equity, private equity sponsored organizations, and early stage organization companies. And the whole goal is to help connect individuals who want to join boards with business owners who are looking for individuals to join their board.
Yeah, that's Richard, a really good idea, Ken.
Grab it. Yeah. Richard, elaborate if you would.
Well, I think what Ken is doing is he sees a need in the marketplace, which is particularly for private companies. Public companies, you know, there's a whole bunch of disclosure, but for private, where does an entrepreneur go to find, qualified directors? So I think what Ken is doing is he's connecting supply and demand, and that's a really great idea.
So, Ken, thank you for calling in on that. And, Richard, let me just stay on that topic for a second more here. Is this a little bit like buying a home? You need a broker. They're going to put you into the market to find the kind of right home that fits you. And so these associations, maybe they're individuals, and you did mention executive search firms along the way that, in a sense, function like a home broker. They put buyers and sellers together. Does that sound right?
Yeah, they're more of intermediaries, Mike, as you said, that connect. They've got the connections that you don't have, but you have the competencies that directors are looking for. So it's a win-win. And it's a like a watering hole that connects both parties, which is a terrific idea. A lot of this tends to be opaque, right? Like there's not really a market for like a stock exchange for finding directors. So the more that these organizations crop up, the better.
Richard, let me follow up. And I know from having worked with Mike, who's written a book called Boards That Lead, that there's been a change in the way that boards have acted over time. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the past, present, and future of boards as you see it?
Yeah, Mike and Ram Charan and Dennis Carey wrote a chapter in my new book on Mike's very good book on contextualizing. And what I liked about Mike's chapter was, which is exactly what you just said, Anne, which is, you know, when and how should boards be assertive, and
right,
when should they hold back? And I think it's fair to say that boards have become much more active in even in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years than they ever were. You know, even 10 years ago they were reasonably passive, but now it's all hands on deck. You've got to be prepared for meetings. You've got to put in the time. You've got to ask the right questions. It's much more demanding now to be a director than it ever was.
And would you say that that's been in response to the financial downturn in 2008, or do you see this as a ongoing trajectory?
It's both. I think 2008 really. I've seen more changes since 2008 than this is. 2008 was not Enron or WorldCom, which was largely implosions. 2008 was a systemic crisis where governments said, you know, we really need to reform governance. So I have not seen I've seen more changes in the last 3, 4, 5 years than I have in a generation. It really is much, much more aggressive in terms of regulators. Like regulators now, they're asking for CVs, they're doing interviews of prospective directors, they're using competency matrices. It's just much more. Regulators want to make sure that the people at that table are the most qualified. That's been mm-hmm. probably the biggest change. So, and this is, it's a moving target, and as you said, it's not going away. If anything, it's probably going to get a bit worse.
Right, and Jeff's question about activists helped us understand that if boards aren't functioning, then activists are going to move the board.
That's right.
All right, Jeff.
All right, so we've talked about the roles boards play, and we've talked about some of the reasons why you'd want to be on a board. Are there, if I'm considering joining a board, you know, what do I need to be careful about, you know, kind of beyond some of the dynamics issues? Are there legal issues? Should I expect a contract or some kind of written statement? Do I need a lawyer to look at it? I'm recruiting.
What's my liability?
I'm recruiting for Jeff Inc. here.
Okay, totally.
You know,
we've been warned.
Right.
People do get, directors get sued, and uh-huh. when a plaintiff's attorney sues, they sue the board as well. Make sure, just two or three things off the top, is make sure you're insured, especially not-for-profit, where there may not be a whole lot of money. Assume the worst-case scenario. What happens mm-hmm. if X, Y, and Z happens? Am I covered? Are my legal fees covered? Do I have, a proper insurance? That's the first thing. The second okay. thing is... how serious is the board, right?
Yeah.
You're on the line for taxes, for unpaid wages, and a lot of not-for-profits don't know this, that right. their personal assets can be at risk for taxes and fees that should have been remitted to employees. So
mm-hmm.
You go in with your eyes wide open. It's a great thing to do, but look at the financial statements of the organization before you even join the board.
Mm-hmm.
Ask for a complete disclosure and sign a confidentiality agreement. I'm not going to release any information, but I want to know what the real deal is before I say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So see the financials, the strategic plan, meet with the CEO ahead of time, meet with two or three directors, talk to the auditors and find out if there's any sort of red flags. The mistake that directors make is they grab their first board without asking the questions. And if you
right.
have the thing in the back of your head that says there's a problem here, then trust your gut. The worst thing is getting on a board and then finding out all this, and then your liability. Even if you resign, you're a director. So I'm not saying all this will happen, but in the mistakes I've seen, it's directors that. They made the decision based on emotion as opposed to being a little more clinical.
Got it. And Richard, these are all the questions we've always wanted to ask about boards but never have. So understanding that not-for-profit boards are typically non-compensated, and chances are the board is one of the sources of funding for the nonprofit. What does compensation look like in private boards? Are there some benchmarks that exist based on the size of the company?
Yeah, generally, comp goes up commensurate with the size and complexity of company.
Right.
So if a private board, they don't have cash, so they tend to give directors options. And then as you become mature and you become more of a public company, then you don't give options, but you give stock. Half stock and half cash, and that ranges from a cash retainer to committee fees to meeting fees. All in for a medium-sized company is probably 50 to 100 to 150. As you begin to get 150,000, and that tends to be a mixture of shares and cash. And then as you begin to get larger, you can make 200, 300. Maybe more in the sort of certainly the Fortune 50. So it tends to range from zero all the way up to 300,000-400,000. And there's a school of thought that that's a lot of money, but to put in the time and to have the responsibilities and the risks.
Sure.
you know, you get what you pay for generally.
Yeah, and you had said before, I mean, 200, if the average directorship is about 278 hours a year, I mean, obviously that's a significant amount of time.
We get down to per hour.
After you guys talk to the auditors and everything, yeah. I do just want to let you know that your roles will be compensated in Jeff Inc. Primarily going to be options and stock for a while, but the future's there.
In fact, there's a phrase around phantom stock options, so maybe we'll issue those to begin with. I just want to quickly remind people we're getting close to our time together. We've been in a great dialogue here with Richard LeBlanc on the faculty at York University and editor of the New Handbook on Corporate Governance. And with only a couple minutes to go before a station break, I think we have a Jay on the phone. So, Jay, are you with us?
Yeah, hello.
Hello. I would love to get a question for Richard from you.
Hi, Richard. This is a very timely discussion for me. I'm trying to get on a board. I've got some great skills. But what I hear back, though, from these recruiters and others is that they look for just CEOs and CFOs. So I was a senior level executive, and I have a lot of skills I think I can bring to a board. But how do I kind of crack that nut in terms of the screening that if they're only looking for a certain type of person? And it does limit the diversity of the board and the thought process of the board by only having CEOs and CFOs. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a heavy bias towards that, and there's a good deal of research. In fact, there's a Stanford study that CEOs make the worst directors because they're too dominant and they're stretched, and CEO is not a competency; it's more of a position. So where regulators are going is they want to see competencies. You could be an IT person that's not a CEO. You could be compensation. You could understand risk. So try to educate the buyer. Joe, that the recruiting firm and ultimately the buyer is not the recruiting firm, it's the nominating committee of the board, that you have competencies that the board needs. I'm seeing climate change competencies now on energy companies. I'm seeing information technology. So whatever your competencies happen to be, highlight those. It's not necessarily whether you're a CEO or not. So sometimes there's a hidden bias there that you might need to sort of address explicitly.
Well, listen, Jay, thanks for calling in. A great question. And with only literally about 2 minutes here remaining, final question from me, Richard. Serving as a board member, Jeff just referenced this number of hours again. We're over 200 hours per year. And of course, it's a real responsibility. And maybe just to say it and then turn it into a question, serving as a board member is a serious business. And I think probably don't want to take it on either in terms of your personal commitment, the time involved, or because you're affecting the lives of others without a willingness to jump in with both feet and do it. So, Richard, does that sound about right to you, or do you want to modify that statement?
No, that's well said, Mike. You hit the nail on the head, yes.
Okay.
It's a great thing to do, but just go in with your eyes wide open.
Terrific. Good. Richard, we really appreciate your joining us on the program.
Questions from Ann and from Jeff and from Mike. It's been a terrific segment for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Annette. As we said several times, Richard is the editor of the New Handbook of Board Governance. You can also reach him on Twitter. And as he mentioned, he's got this major, I call it a network for people who want to think about boards, going on boards, and what you do once you're there.